Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXXXIII, The Rise of Diocles. The man who would be Emperor Diocletian was of unremarkable origins. Quick to recognise the challenges of Rome, he decided to set up a franchise opportunity. This worked when nothing else did, and to many, he was the most successful Roman emperor in an age. Just don't ask the Christians. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
We've had to say goodbye to the Historia Augusta, so we don't have a series of imperial biographies anymore. But in other ways, source material becomes much richer, actually. So we continue to have the mid-4th century works by Aurelius Victor and Eutropius, both of which deal sort of in a potted way with the emperors and the events of their reign. But we also have some exciting new sources. And some of these are Christian sources. And we need to bear in mind that they're incredibly hostile to Diocletian and many of his colleagues this time period, because Diocletian inaugurates what's known as the Great Persecution of the Christians in AD 303. One of these works is by a man called Lactantius. He is an orator and a teacher of rhetoric from North Africa, and he is a Christian, and he is actually appointed professor of Latin at Nicomedia, which, as we'll find out, is Diocletian's major capital, major residence through most of this period. And so he reports some of the things that happen in Nicomedia as an eyewitness. And he then goes on to be a tutor in Latin to the sons of Constantine.
Wow.
So he's a really important figure throughout this period. And he writes some works, you know, that are about sort of Christian theology, for example. But he also writes this invective history, as we call it, called On the Deaths of the Persecutors. And so these are all the pagan emperors, particularly of the late 3rd and early 4th centuries, who obviously persecute Christians, and the grisly deaths that they suffer. And so you get wonderful stories about, you know, their bodies being eaten alive by worms and things like that as divine retribution by Christ. But he also covers a lot of historical information that we don't get from anywhere else. And his work was completed in about 316, 317. So it's very close to the time period as well. And as I said, you know, he was in Nicomedia while Diocletian was ruling. So Lactantius is a really important writer. Another Christian author is Eusebius. He is the bishop of Caesarea. And in the reign of Constantine, so, you know, Constantine comes to power in 312 when he defeats Maxentius at the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And then there's various edicts restoring freedom of worship, for example. But Eusebius writes sort of the first continuous history written from a Christian perspective. So he goes back and, you know, talks about what happens under Nero, for example, and Domitian,
right,
etc.
Way back.
Yeah. But then it gets incredibly more detailed the closer he gets to the time. So the church history, that's a really important work. And then we also have a collection of panegyrics. Panegyrics are speeches of praise, and these are speeches of praise delivered for emperors. So listeners may remember way back in the time of Trajan, we have Pliny the Younger's panegyric for Trajan delivered when he is consul. Panegyric continues throughout this period, but they don't survive. For example, Fronto wrote one for Antoninus Pius, but it doesn't survive. So every time a consul takes office at the beginning of the year, they would deliver a speech in praise of the emperor, and also speeches in praise would be delivered at sort of, you know, after important military victories, etc. It's from this period that these speeches start to survive again. So we have 9 surviving speeches from the age of Diocletian and Constantine, from the late 3rd to the early 4th century. And the first one dates 289, for example. So early in this period. And then, you know, we go throughout the 290s and then, you know, the 310s. And most of these speeches were delivered by Gauls, Gallic orators, in praise of emperors who are largely resident at Trier. So Trier, now in Germany, became the major sort of capital campaigning base for emperors at this time. And they seem to have been put together as a collection. Then two other panegyrics were added, one for Julian and one for the Emperor Theodosius. And they were then put together with Pliny's Panegyricus as a collection of 12. So that's how they all survive today.
Okay.
But there are many from this period. And yes, their speech is in praise of emperors. So, of course, they give the best spin on things. But they do actually provide really important details about political events as well. So this is really, really exciting. I really like these speeches because, you know, after, you know, decades of dealing with fragmentary sources, suddenly you have a full speech in 289 delivered for an emperor.
Okay, well, that sounds great, and we will wade into that. But our story starts in, 284?
Yes, so 284. This is when Gaius Valerius Diocles, who is the commander of the Protectores Domestici, the imperial bodyguard, kills the Praetorian prefect Appa because he claims that he's responsible for the death of the emperor Numerian and then is proclaimed emperor himself.
Okay, so what do we know about his background then, or what are we told about his background? Some of this, we should say, are still sketchy Historia Augusta facts, because he deals with Diocles in the closing of the life of Carus and Sons.
That's exactly right. And so we do know that he was Danubian, so part of the Danubian military elite, probably from Dalmatia, likely near modern Split, ancient Salona. That's where he actually goes to retire. The magnificent palace that he built for himself now is a large part of modern Split. I've stayed in a hotel within the walls of Diocletian's palace, which is really exciting.
Yeah.
And I think did you have an episode of When in Rome on the palace?
Well remembered, yeah. Yes. With Christopher Gribben.
That's right. Yes. Yeah.
He leads tours around there all the time, pretty much every year.
Oh, I'm very envious. Yeah. it's a great place to visit. Diocles is probably about 40 at the time. Again, like many of these soldier emperors, not of high status. According to one story, he's the son of a scribe, so a minor official. Another story, he himself is a freedman of a senator called Anilinus. So either way, you know, not distinguished birth.
No.
He marries a woman called Aurelia Prisca, but we know virtually nothing about her. One of the features of the late 3rd century is that we know so little about the imperial women.
Mm.
We know he had a military career. One suggestion that he commanded forces on the Lower Danube. We don't quite know. But then, yes, he is commander of the Protectores on the Persian campaign. So he goes with Carus and Numerian. Then he kills Appa and proclaimed emperor on the 20th of November 284.
So this is grain of salt territory.
Mm.
The Historia Augusta does have a nice bit of myth building about Diocles being foretold as being the emperor.
That's right. So this is from the Life of Carus, chapter 14. And this is good fun. This is a story told by the H.A. author's grandfather, who he says was on the scene when Diocles killed Appa. It says, when Diocletian was serving in a minor post, he was stopping at a certain tavern in the land of the Tungri in Gaul and was making up his daily reckoning with a woman who was a druidess. She said to him, Diocletian, you are far too greedy and far too stingy. To which Diocletian replied, it is said, not in earnest, but only in jest, I shall be generous enough when I become emperor. At this the druidess said, so he related, do not jest, Diocletian, for you will become emperor when you have slain a boar. And the Latin word for the boar is Appa.
Who's the person that he killed?
Yeah. Yes. So the Praetorian prefect, Lucius Flavius Appa.
Nice bit of double meaning there. And I have continued my notes here by saying that, sorry, firstly, appreciate the voice work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
That would have been a story that Diocletian would have been happy with, I imagine.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. You know, you could tell that over and over again, you know.
So what was the deal with, we call him Diocletian, but we were calling him Diocles up to a certain point as well in the last episode, maybe at the start of this one as well. So yes. Where does the changeover happen, and is that a modern changeover, or was he calling himself Diocletian back then as well?
No, he changed his name back then. A papyrus dated to the 7th of March 285, so that's a few months after his elevation in November, still gives him the name Diocles. And Lactantius, in his On the Death of the Persecutor, always refers to him as Diocles. This is a way of, you know, needling his low origin.
Yeah.
So everyone knew that that was his original name. However, soon after, in 285, he becomes Imperator Caesar Gaius Aurelius Valerius Diocletianus. We don't quite know why, except the fact that it is grander sounding. Diocles is, you know, his more humble birth name. It associates him with his origin, Greek name. It's often held by slaves, for example. Whereas Diocletianus is, you know, much grander and, you know, signals a change. So at some point he decided that that would be his name as emperor.
Interesting. He didn't want to sound too provincial.
Exactly.
So he's calling himself emperor from this point, 20th of November 284.
That's right.
But he's contesting. He's the usurper in this, and he has a rival emperor that he's got to take care of.
That's right. Quirinus is still alive in the West. And so you see Diocletian gathering supporters. So it's often quite wrongly argued that Diocletian was estranged from senators. I don't believe that is the case. So there is a senator on the campaign, because emperors don't go anywhere without their trusted advisors, and he has the wonderful name of Lucius Caesonius Avinius Manlius Rufinianus Bassus. Mm. And an inscription tells us that he was a comes, an official companion of Carus and Numerian on the Persian campaign. He was on the scene when Appa was killed. And so Diocletian, he doesn't wait for January. He becomes consul immediately in November and makes Bassus his co-consul there.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's already building those connections with the senatorial aristocracy.
If there's any loyalty to Quirinus, then this is eroding it, really.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And then, you know, we've talked about the defeat of Quirinus at the Battle of the River Margus. And one thing that we know is that Quirinus's Praetorian prefect, Aristobulus, who is named consul by Quirinus, is actually retained by Diocletian as well. So, you know, he's building these connections. It's not a purge, especially if Quirinus is being murdered by his own men. You know, they've done Diocletian a favour. He goes to northern Italy next. He doesn't go to Rome because he is a military emperor. You know, this was standard by this stage. In a lot of the older scholarship, you know, there's a book by Michael Arnheim from 1972 when he calls Diocletian the hammer of the aristocracy. And Stephen Williams' biography of Diocletian also repeats some of these tropes that Diocletian hated senators, that he was estranged from them. I don't think that was the case. You do find senators actually governing important provinces like Syria, for example, serving in key judicial positions. So, you know, certainly he didn't base himself in Rome. So there's that different relationship there. But individual senators were still important as supporters.
So what do we know then about his early days as emperor?
Well, one of the first things he does after the defeat of Quirinus is to appoint a co-emperor. We know that Diocletian has a daughter, but he doesn't have any sons. He doesn't have any family to turn to, but he does have his military family, that is, this military brotherhood. And so in July 285 at Milan in North Italy, Diocletian appoints one of these fellow officers, Marcus Aurelius Valerius Maximianus, who we know as Maximian today, as Caesar. So as a junior emperor. And Maximian is from relatively similar background as well. He's from a family of shopkeepers near Sirmium. You know, that's where Probus was from, for example. And we know that he had very probably accompanied Diocletian, Carus, Numerian on the Persian campaign as well.
Yeah, if you're going to put somebody in this sort of position, you want to have them really trustworthy. So I imagine they've had a long career together.
That's right. And we can get a sense of how the administration portrays the Danubian emperors through these panegyrics. So, for example, this is 285 we're currently in, but there are speeches delivered in praise of Maximian in Gaul that survive from 289 and 291. And they're usually called the panegyric of 289 and 291 because we don't know the identity of the authors.
Okay.
So we know that they are prominent Gallic aristocrats. There's one suggestion that one of them is delivered by an official called Mamertinus, but we don't quite know. These, you know, make a big deal of Maximian's origin in Pannonia. So the speech of 289 says, "Or shall I proclaim how you have been raised and taught on that frontier, in that seat of the bravest of legions, midst the manoeuvres of a vigorous youth and the clash of arms echoing your infant cries?" So, you know, the military is part of his blood from birth. In 291, the orator says, "For you were not born and raised in some quiet part of the world, a land enfeebled by luxury, but in those provinces whose border exposed to the enemy, though they are a beaten enemy, and always arrayed in arms, has taught them the tireless habit of toil and patience, in the provinces where all of life is military service, whose women even are braver than the men of other lands."
It's really praising humble origins.
Yes.
Which
yes.
is not something that I'd pick out for a quality of the emperor, but it's like, no, you should be proud of being such a salt of the earth kind of person.
And that's part of this really important transformation that we find in the late 3rd century, is that you need to make their origin work for them.
Mm.
And so there's a handbook on how to deliver speeches of praise, which is written by a Greek called Menanderita. So it's written about this same time. And it says, you know, if the emperor is undistinguished, you can just ignore his origins. You don't need to go into that.
Mm.
But what these orators do is they actually make a statement of imperial suitability. And, you know, this is something that hasn't happened before and, you know, shows how these orators are really quite clever shaping the public image of these emperors. Sometimes they're compared to like spin doctors, you know, that they use it to portray the emperors in the best light.
I mean, it's a bit of a hype man kind of job, but I can imagine Maximian hearing this and this being delivered before Maximian to like big him up to the audience.
Yeah.
But also I wonder how this kind of language, this kind of origin story would go down well in Trier.
Yep.
For the local audience.
Yes, yes.
But if this was something written in Rome,
yes,
you mightn't emphasize the humble origin story so much.
Yes. Yeah, and that's the thing. A lot of these orators are delivering these to this Gallic audience, and that's really important. You have to tell things to the audience. And for them, they're so close to the Rhine frontier and, you know, potential of barbarian raids, invasion, disrupting their lives.
It's relatable. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So do we know or can we posit why Diocletian thought it was worth appointing not just a general to act in his stead, but actually making somebody a co-ruler?
I think he probably saw the benefits for Carus, Carinus, and Numerian, that they had, you know, been able to cope with multiple incursions on different frontiers, whereas someone like Probus, who he almost certainly served under as well, you know, was running about the empire, and so was Aurelian as well. And the idea of having a group of emperors in an age where emperors are supposed to be everywhere would have really appealed to Diocletian. He didn't have any sons. He only had a daughter. His wife may have now been beyond childbearing age, so he may have thought, well, we're not going to have that traditional sign of dynasty.
Mm.
There was already major internal problems in the West, so Maximian's first task is to put down a revolt in Gaul by a group known as the Bagaldi, who essentially bandits. Bagaldi is probably a Celtic word meaning just warriors, but there's a rebellion in Gaul. But of course, there's problems on the Danube on the eastern frontier. So it's a good way to split the load as well. And perhaps, you know, if something goes wrong in Gaul, well, it's only the junior emperor who's been killed. So I want to emphasize, you know, the fragility of Diocletian's regime in its early years. As you quite rightly point out, he was a usurper, and we think it's inevitable that, you know, he would go on to reign for 20 years, but it wasn't inevitable at the time.
Mm. You'd have to be really careful about who you're appointing the co-emperor in that instance. You'd want somebody that you could really trust so that they don't just outright challenge you once they're put in charge of an army and given a bit of territory to run around after. And
that's right. And it's clear that Maximian was carefully chosen as someone that he'd served with for a long time.
Mm.
And it's quite interesting. He's not adopted as a son. He's a bit younger than Diocletian, only about 5 years, but he still could have been formally adopted.
Yeah.
But he's not. He's not married to Prisca. I mean, Maximian already has a wife and children. And so the image that is promoted is of Diocletian and Maximian as brothers, what we call the fraternal ideology. And in the Panegyric of 291, the orator says, "What full or twin brothers share an undivided inheritance so fairly as you share the Roman world?" The idea is that as brothers, they can make sure that Rome is protected.
That is written by somebody who does not have kids.
Exactly. I can tell you my twin boys do not share anything fairly at all. And indeed, you know, twins and brothers, they've, you know, Romulus and Remus, you know.
Yeah,
it's not always the best paradigm.
So we now have more or less a clear division. You go east, I go west.
Yes. There's no line drawn or something like that. Sometimes you'll read, this is when the Roman Empire was first divided into two. Diocletian is Augustus. He is the senior emperor. Maximian is Caesar. But it means that because the two of them, they can handle different spheres of operations. And for most of the time, Diocletian is largely concerned with the Danubian region and the Persian frontier.
All right. Should we take Diocletian first? What is he confronted with? What's he doing?
Yes. So he goes straight to the Danube, where he is doing battle against the Sarmatians. And then he goes in 286 to spend the first 3 months of the year at Nicomedia, very close to where he took power. And this actually becomes his major capital in the sense that he is based there more often than anywhere else. He devotes time to expanding, beautifying the city, building new palaces, for example. We hear all this from Lactantius, who criticizes him for this, but he really makes it into an imperial center. Recent excavations from Nicomedia have turned up these wonderful coloured friezes, which show both Diocletian and Maximian embracing each other.
Oh, nice.
And that's something that has, you know, only really been published in the last couple of years. So it's a real contribution to our understanding of how significant Nicomedia was to Diocletian.
But that's interesting as well, as this is the way that you want these two men to be shown at the empire, you know, embracing, they're acting as one.
That's exactly right. Diocletian, as a senior emperor based at Nicomedia, he can go to the Danube very quickly. He can go to the east very quickly.
Mm.
And we don't have too many details about what happens in the east, but the Panegyric of 289, which is delivered in honor of Maximian in Gaul, does reference what Diocletian has been up to. One of the issues is that we have no panegyrics directly delivered for Diocletian.
Mm.
Most of them are for Maximian and then Constantius the First, who we'll meet later. We hear about Diocletian through references. In 289, the orator says, "In just the same way, I believe, did the Euphrates shelter the rich and fertile land of Syria in its embrace, so to speak, before the Persian realm voluntarily submitted itself to Diocletian." And then later on, he says, "In the same manner, the great king of Persia, who has never before deigned to confess he is but a man, makes supplication to your brother," that is Diocletian. So there does seem to be a settlement that is achieved, possibly in 286 or more likely in 287, which allows the appointment of a Roman nominee to the throne of Armenia, Tiridates III. And regular listeners of this podcast will realize that, you know, who gets to name the king of Armenia, the Parthian/Persian or Roman, is always a major topic of debate. So there seems to have been a major diplomatic victory there for Diocletian.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like there was a battle really involved or any subjugation or anything. Or,
no,
yeah, interesting.
No.
where in earlier years there might have been.
Yes, so this may be due to the fact that Bahram II is still in a slightly precarious position, and before too long he's going to be replaced.
So meanwhile, what is Maximian doing in the West?
His main mission is to defeat the Bagaldae. So as I said, you know, these aren't a tribe, it's a Celtic word, probably meaning the warriors. So we find Bagaldae not only in the 3rd century, but also in the 5th century as well. And this is a serious problem. You might think this is just an internal revolt, you know, why can't the local administration deal with that? But what we see are farmers, shepherds, they're turning to brigandage when they can't pay their taxes, and they're finding their own leaders. You might remember back in the episode about Probus, you find Lydius, who is the rebel leader in Isauria.
And his merry men.
His merry men, yes, exactly. And he doesn't proclaim himself emperor. However, the Bagaldae are led by two emperors, Amandus and Aelianus, and there are coins recognizing Amandus as emperor. They're not just rebels. And remember the Gallic Empire, that split off, you know, in the time of Gallienus. So Diocletian doesn't want this to happen again. Hence, you know, you need Maximian. And we have a really interesting insight into this phenomenon, a treatise called De Rebus Bellicis on Matters of War, written in the late 4th century. We don't know its author, but it was dedicated to the emperors Valentinian and Valens. And this author writes, and I quote, "The poor are driven by their afflictions into various criminal enterprises, and losing sight of all respect for law, all feelings of loyalty, they have entrusted their revenge to crime. For they often inflicted the most severe injuries on the empire, laying waste to the fields, breaking the peace with outbursts of brigandage, stirring up animosities, and, passing from one crime to another, they supported usurpers." So we find, you know, poor economic conditions turning people to brigandage, but then they look for their own leaders. So it becomes, you know, a major political problem for the emperors. And this is why I think Diocletian appointed Maximian, you know, he raised him to the rank of Caesar to show there's imperial authority.
I mean, this is why a Roman emperor needs to provide the people with their bread and circuses.
That's right.
Because as soon as you don't have your bread, get a sword.
Yeah. Or they lose their land.
Yeah.
And, you know, under the Gallic Empire, you know, there were also armies marching through this territory as well. We often think of Gaul as this sort of lush and fertile territory, and it is. But there's armies marching through this area in civil wars. Maximian suppresses the Bagaldae successfully, and the orator who delivers the panegyric in 289 says this was a time when inexperienced farmers sought military garb, the ploughman imitated the infantryman, the shepherd the cavalryman, the rustic ravager the barbarian enemy. So, you know, the idea is that Rome's own people are turning against it, and this is a problem that Maximian has solved.
This doesn't sound like it's a triumph-worthy victory.
There's no triumph, but if you're thinking of giving it to Trier, you know, a lot of the audience are going to be rich landowners. They're very happy with this having been suppressed. But the thing about Maximian, which makes him triumph worthy, I suppose, is that he goes straight from that to the Rhine frontier. And this is where it's being threatened by the Burgundians, the Alemanni, the Tribones, and the Heruli. And the panegyric praises Maximian for leading the army in person, getting in and fighting from the front like a good general. Almost like he's better than an entire army, because the orator says, "For what need was there of a multitude when you yourself took part in the fray, when you yourself did battle in each spot and over the whole land of the battlefield, when you yourself ran to counter the foe everywhere?" Real sense that it's you doing everything. That repetition, "you yourself," is a literary technique we know as anaphora, for those of you taking notes at home. But, you know, that kind of repetition emphasizes that we owe everything this to you. And so on the 1st of April 286, in recognition of his successes, Diocletian makes Maximian Augustus, so a co-emperor. Diocletian is still the senior Augustus, but Maximian is now also an Augustus. And about this time, or soon after, the emperors take what are known as theophoric signa, which is a fancy way of saying the names of gods or names derived from gods.
Mm.
So Diocletian becomes Jovius, the Jovian one, derived from Jupiter, and Maximian becomes Herculius, the one who's like Hercules, essentially.
Yeah.
So this emphasizes their seniority because Jupiter is king of the gods. So it emphasizes that as well as their strengths, you know, the fact that they are able to lead from the front.
It strikes me a little bit how you've got kings who have titles of the great or the wise.
Yes, yes.
Is that the sort of styling that they're going for here or that they're starting? This is a new vogue, maybe.
Commodus did want to be known as the Roman Hercules, so there's that going back. But, you know, you find these titles, they appear in the panegyrics, the Jovian one, the Herculean one, and they have these sort of dynasties that will start as well, the Jovian dynasty and the Herculean dynasty as well.
And it does very much emphasize just how well they work together, that they complement each other's strengths and weaknesses, emphasizing how much of a partnership this is.
Yes, they're a united front.
That was Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University, and you've been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching platform. Please leave a review, they are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also find us on Blue Sky. Kaelin is Dr. C. Davenport, I am Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is Rome Podcast. This podcast is produced at La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.